So first, thanks for answering the quiz. And it seems that one question maybe was not super clear, so I'm going to come back on that. And also there were some remark about the difference between self-adjoint operator and Hermitian operator. So I won't really take the time to do that now, but I will add a question in the next tutorial and we can discuss in the tutorial. So of course this distinction is only important if you're working with infinite infinite dimensional system. Okay, and I guess in the first part of the course with Aggie, you've mainly focused on finite dimensional system. So that's kind of what is also going to be the difference with this part of the course, where we're going to work with infinite dimensional system. I won't talk so much about the subtlety, what you have to be careful about, because usually everything is going to work, but it just, I want you to be aware that if you want to do things properly, then you have to be careful sometimes, okay? So the next part of this course, the second half, is going to be about mainly the path integral formulation. But in order to introduce the path integral formulation for quantum mechanics, what I want to do today is to kind of remind you quickly the canonical quantization. So usually it's what you should be more or less all kind of familiar with this formulation, because it's what is done usually in main quantum mechanics textbooks. But I just want to make sure that everyone has a different notion clear. In particular, in the quiz, it seems that maybe not everyone is so familiar with the Heisenberg picture or this kind of thing. So I just want to kind of, again, to go quickly through that, okay? And so in the first part of the course, you focus on what is called the operational framework, which is kind of based on a minimal set of axioms, and where the abstract element of the theory will refer to usually experimental procedures, okay? So now we're going to go to a different formalism. I think Aggie is in her first lecture kind of introduced that in quantum mechanics there are different formalism, and some of the formalism are more useful in different contexts. So here the idea is with the path integral formalism is kind of to get you ready for quantum field theory. We're going to see that it's not going to simplify anything in the quantum mechanics context to use path integral, but it's a good way to introduce the tools that then you're going to use in quantum field theory, okay? So this is kind of the idea. Okay, so to start with, what I want to do is, so let's imagine, because so with the operational formalism, you kind of have a very advanced formalism, which has been thought. It's not the first formalism that was quantum mechanics was not introduced in this way. But now you have seen that indeed a good way to compare classical mechanics to quantum mechanics is maybe to think about classical mechanics instead of probabilistic theory. It's what you have seen with Aggie. But if you imagine that you were a scientist at the end, a physicist at the end of the 19th century, and you knew that you should incorporate some quantum effects, but the only thing, and that also quantum mechanics, what you know today is that quantum mechanics reproduces all the successes of classical mechanics. You can expect that you have still strong similarities between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics. And so what, at the end of the 19th century, what physicists knew? They knew that the Planck constant, H, which play a fundamental role in the quantum mechanics law, and even in 19, Planck already postulated that light of frequency f could only be emitted in packets of energy h. So for you would have this relation where h is a constant, and which means that the light could be consisting of particles. And this was something new at this time. And to be consistent with heat radiation, the spectrum measurement of heat radiation, Planck found already the value of this constant. So I'm going to give it to you because it's kind of nice to have sometime in mind how small things are or big things are if you want to talk about. So here it's a minus 34. And also it gives you the unit of this constant, okay? So you can see that this unit is going to be the unit of an action. So maybe there is no, yeah. It'd be the same unit as an action, okay? So if you were one physicist at the beginning of the 20th century or the end of the 19th century, what would be your strategy to get the quantum mechanics law? You could start from Newton's mechanic, meaning that you have this F is equal to ma, and try to introduce H in it. So I'm going to give you like maybe three options, and I let you think about why it could work or not. So let me, I don't know if everyone can read on this side of the on the blackboard. So these are three options. So can you think quickly about a quick argument why none of these options is in fact working? And why, in fact, it's, if you really think about it, it's none of the attempts to kind of improve Newton's law in such a manner have been working out, okay? So for example, for this one, why, what is a quick argument?
Dimensionally correct.
Yeah, okay, so as I said, H as the dimension of an action. So m squared, the length square, mass divided by time. So yeah, this is an issue of dimension. Then here, I introduced the product xp. So xp has the same dimension of h, okay? So I don't have any issue of dimension now. So what would be a quick argument here?
It's too big.
Yeah, so if in just in everyday life, if xp is kind of big, then it would, you would expect that you have quantum gravity effect in everyday life, okay? And here, what can you say about this?
Small.
Yeah, it's just if xp is small, then you get huge effect. And it has been done that, yeah, quantum mechanical effect haven't been observed for many centuries. So you know that the effect are still small. So it's a kind of same thing. So any attempt to try to improve or modify Newton's law hasn't been working to get to quantum mechanics. And in fact, the way quantum mechanics has been introduced initially was proposed by Heisenberg and Schrödinger, and it didn't look very similar to classical mechanics. So it's only Dirac that kind of makes the connection between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, but from starting from the Hamiltonian formulation of classical mechanics. And this is what canonical quantization is about. It's really starting from the Hamiltonian formulation of classical mechanics and see some similarity. So this is what we're going to see today. So of course, there are some limitations to this formulation that you can find few arguments in the lecture note if you're interested, or at least a reference where it is kind of explained better. But it's still super useful. It's still what you're going to, you can use that to quantize the electromagnetic field to get to quantum electromagnetism. Or, for example, I'm working in quantum gravity, and in the loop quantum gravity approach, we kind of, it's kind of based on the canonical quantization, of course. Then the difficulty is that we're working with what is called a totally constrained system, so you have all this kind of issue, but still, it's still kind of used. And it's also going to allow us to review some many concepts and mathematical objects, like the notion of Hilbert space, the notion of self-adjoint operators. And mainly what I'm going to focus today is on the what is going to be the tools that then you will need to go to the path integral formulation, okay? So I'm not going to cover everything. I'm trying to go kind of quickly. Don't hesitate to stop if you have questions, if something is not clear, or if something you want to go deeper. If I don't have time now, we can also use sometimes tutorials to explore some ideas. So don't hesitate. Okay, so as I said, the idea of the canonical quantization is the Hamiltonian formalism of classical mechanics. So I'm just going to, so this is also going to give me the opportunity to come back on this question that was on the quiz that was maybe not very clear, where I wrote everything using this curly bracket that you, of course, interpret as the Poisson bracket, and was asking you which of these properties are going to hold at the quantum level. Okay, and maybe one aspect was not really clear is that I started with, so this side is going to be the classical part, so it's the Hamiltonian formulation. And the starting point is, of course, so the starting point, then before going to the bracket, is you have an Hamiltonian function. Okay, which is an energy function. And we consider that it's a function on your phase space variable. Okay, so I'm going to use the terminology phase space here. So by phase space, I mean configuration variable plus the conjugated momentum. Okay, so here, for simplicity, I'm going to consider that it's a one-dimensional system with a usual Q and usual P. Of course, it can be more dimension. It can also be generalized coordinates here, that you can have different kind of coordinates, but just for simplicity here. And so this is the starting point. Then what I had in mind in my question with this bracket on the quiz was that you have some canonical conjugated variable, and these are your canonical variables. So here it's the x and p, and with the bracket it's equal to 1. Okay, and you need to know what are your conjugated variable, your canonical variables of your phase space. Okay, this is a kind of the starting point. Then my point was that usually, so in particular when you have a complicated function of your phase space, the way you represent this bracket is using derivatives. But this is only really a representation. It's not a fundamental property of your bracket, if you want. It's, you can really define the bracket in a much more axiomatic and abstract way. And by this, this was the other property that was in the quiz, which are that this bracket has to be antisymmetric, that it has to be linear. It has to be, you have an additional rule. You have a product rule. And which property am I missing here? Yeah, the Jacobi identity. Yep. Okay, and all these properties, in fact, abstractly are going to indeed, all these properties are also valid for the commutator that you know at the quantum level. Okay? So this define where the representation in terms of derivative is not going to be valid. And in fact, this is an important property that the set of polynomials in P and Q is what we call a Poisson algebra. So what is a Poisson algebra? It's a vector space with two multiplication. And one multiplication makes this vector space into an associative algebra. And the other multiplication, which is in fact the bracket in this case, is non-associative. It's non-associative because, of course, you have the Jacobi identity. Okay, so this is telling you that it's non-associative. And it's called a Lie bracket, okay, as the commutator will be called, is also a Lie bracket. Okay. And you also want that these two multiplications are compatible. Then this set is called a Poisson algebra. So here, what are in our specific case of this classical phase space, what are our two multiplications? So here, so to have a Poisson algebra, you have two multiplications. So here, we have the multiplication that I'm going to denote like this, which is just the point wise product between two. So I have two functions, g, the product of gh, that are phase space function, is just the product of g okay, so this is a what we call the point wise product, and this, of course, this multiplication is associative. Okay, and then the second one is the Lie bracket or the Poisson bracket that we call Poisson bracket in this case, but it's more generally a Lie bracket, so it could be here indeed the commutator. And it's non-associative, and this is indeed, you can see that from the Jacobi identity. Okay. And what is the compatibility here? So this one is not working at all. Okay. Good to know. And so the compatibility here is just given, in fact, by this product rule. So I can rewrite it using my notation with this M. So if I have the Poisson bracket, the Lie bracket between F and the product of two other functions that I call A and B here. So maybe, so here it just means that it's the product of these two functions. Then what you get is that indeed you have, this is M. So you use the pointwise product here of this new function, which is given by F and B, plus the product, the pointwise product between F and A with B. So this is my other function. Okay, and this is in fact just a way to rewrite the product rule. Okay, and this is the Jacobi identity. Okay, so this is at the classical level, and these are indeed, if you think about at this abstract level, all these properties are going to go to the quantum level. So even the fact that X and P are canonical variable, of course here I had some comment in the quiz, and you're right, the constant that you get here is different. You get a I H bar in addition. Okay, so it's not the same. But it's still, my point was that you still have this kind of okay, so this would be quantum. And then all these other properties are still satisfied by the now the Poisson bracket. Of course, now the product is going to be different because this you're going to talk about multiplication between operators. So it's kind of different how you represent them. If you represent them as matrices, then you have the product between matrices. But it's still, of course, it's associative. Okay? So you keep this one, the important point is that it's associative. Okay, then what else do we have at the classical level? So I was thinking to use one same board, but I'm going to go to this side. Then if you have a phase space function, the time evolution of this phase space function is given by, in the, what is the equation, or how right do I write this equation? So F is a general phase space function. What would be, well, I help you. I already started the equation, so don't have so many choices now.
So Poisson bracket
with the Hamilton. Yeah. Okay. So F and H, and do you know the name of this kind of equation? So let's start with the H. So it's Hamilton equation, and of course, if F is just your x variable, okay, then you recover, yeah, the one that x and p. Of course, the simplest function, phase space function that you have is x and p themselves, okay? And so if you go to the quantum level, it's directly generalized into what we call the Heisenberg function. So now I'm going to add a small hat to say that it's a different object, that here it's a number-valued function, okay? We're going to see that indeed some of the property, classical properties that are not going to hold are going to make that this has to be something different than just a number function, just a linear map. Usually we're going to consider. And yeah, so you really generalize this by. And now these are called the Heisenberg. Equation, and of course, maybe you're more familiar when F, the operator F, so now we're going to talk about operators, are going to be X and P. So as I mentioned, this F function or this X function are a function of time, usually. all your phase-space function are function of time at the classical level, and there are number-valued function. So, and why is it important? It's because, indeed, one other assumption that we had at the classical level is that, for example, the measurement of the position is compatible with the measurement of the momentum. Okay, and you can see that in everyday life. Now we all have on our phone a GPS, okay? And the GPS is going to give you very precisely at the same time your position and your velocity, okay? So at, in our everyday life experience, this is fine to have this hypothesis that the measurement of X and P are compatible. And so what does it mean that they're mathematically that they're compatible? How would you express that? That is something that we're, of course, going to lose at the quantum level. So as I already give you kind of a hint, what is important is that it's this function of number valued function. So, and here the product we're using is this pointwise product that is commutative, okay? So of course you have the commutativity here. It is that physically mean that measurement of the position and momentum are compatible here. Okay, so this is, but in that when you go at the quantum level, what you know is that now we have this Heisenberg uncertainty. Principle. And this was one of the bonus questions in the tutorial yesterday, that if you have this uncertainty principle, then, or the other way around, if it's not commutative, then you have the. So here, you cannot know simultaneously momentum and position at the quantum level. And this implies that indeed, you cannot keep that X and P are just number-valued function, but you need to go to kind of maps, and it's, we use the simplest map that we have, the linear maps. And you have seen in the tutorial yesterday that one of the simple way to represent linear map is to use matrices, okay? So yesterday you kind of use an explicit representation of X and P in terms of infinite dimensional matrices. And there is another property that we have here at the classical level that this we're going to, so is that the measurement values are real, okay? And so here is just translated by simple mathematically by this. And you keep, we keep this reality condition at the quantum level, and so which makes that we want to use Hermitian map, okay? So again, I will come back on this difference between Hermitian and self-adjoint. So self-adjoint really means that they are equal. So what you want is also that the domains of definition are equal, okay? And when it's infinite dimensional, then it's you have some subtleties between Hermitian and self-adjoint. Okay, any questions here?
I still don't get how you clarified the question that, like, the fact that, so the definition of the Poisson bracket does not hold in quantum mechanics. I didn't quite get that question in the quiz. I didn't get how.
Okay, so yeah, so the question in the quiz was, so I gave you kind of a list of property of the Poisson bracket.
Yeah.
That was, so this one, all this one written explicitly. And I added the definition in terms of derivative. Okay, and so the question was kind of which property still hold at the quantum level? And so my point was all these abstract property of the Poisson bracket are the definition of a Poisson algebra. And if you go to the quantum level with a commutator, you still have them. Okay, then we were left with these two properties. So this property is clearly only valid classically. Okay, and my point was that this is just, so here it's really the abstract axiomatic way to define the bracket. Usually for a practical reason, you use this definition, you use this, but this is not really a definition, it's more a representation. So it's a way to represent your bracket that it can be convenient in some situation. And this is just a representation that is valid classically. Okay, so you cannot represent the commutator this way. So this one was not. And then I guess the tricky part was about, yeah, how to interpret this one. So here, what I wanted to say is that this, when you start from a phase space, you have to determine which are your, or it's going to tell you, the dynamics is going to tell you which are your canonically conjugated variables, okay, your fundamental variable that is going to divide all your phase space function. And you have this canonical bracket. Okay, and so my point was that, yeah, indeed, even at the quantum level, you're still going to have some basic function operators now that are going to be, so this x and p, okay, and they still satisfy a canonical commutator. Okay, so my answer was that indeed this is kind of preserved at the quantum level. The point is that indeed this constant is not the same. You have this I h bar. But yeah, so it was a question of how do you interpret that? Of course, if you want that it's exactly the same, it was not true. But I say in my answer, I was saying, yeah, it is, because I was more thinking about these variables are the fundamental variables, and you still have kind of fundamental operators satisfying this one.
So like, why is this representation not valid? Like, is it because it's hard, like, I don't get why it's not valid in the quantum regime.
Yeah, so in the quantum regime, you're going to work, these are going to be operators. So then, of course, you can choose how to represent this operator. So then again, it's a choice of representation. So usually we choose to represent them as matrices. But the definition then of this bracket is just by commutator. Is by definition of the commutator, okay? Where here, what is the product you have depends on how you represent these operators, okay? You could choose to represent them differently. One could be represented as a differential operator, one as a function. But so you see, this is the definition of your commutator, but you don't, here you're really working with function. And you see that the fact that you have a derivative appearing in the Poisson bracket is really part of the definition of this Poisson, of the way you represent the Poisson bracket itself, not of the way you represent the operator. Okay. And so this is not, you're never going to have this. You can represent P as a differential operator, but this comes from the way you represent your operator itself, not the commutator. So, but I don't know if it answers your question. Okay, any more questions? Okay, so maybe one. Last point is then, yeah, so now we have a kind of equation. So it seems that we know how to solve a quantum mechanical problem. And yes, in a sense, you can find. So yesterday, what you did in the tutorial was to find a explicit representation for x and p. So then you could, for a given system, now that you have h, you could solve this equation. For example, it's a good exercise for you to try to do that using the matrix representation that we had yesterday, okay, to solve the free particle. Okay, as so, solve this equation explicitly. So it seems that, yeah, then you have, you will find x fp as a function of time for any time, okay, starting from a given initial condition. And you can check that at any time, x and p are still Hermitian matrices. They're still satisfying the commutation relation. So this is satisfied, and they still satisfy, of course, the equation of motion. So the time evolution is, of course, preserving the commutation relation and the Hermiticity property. So this is important. But usually you expect also as an outcome to have a number. So now we have some matrices. So how do you get a number from that? And so there are different ways. If you have a matrix A, a good way to get a number is, if you're familiar with the Dirac notation, is to introduce. So the question now is, how do you get a number as outcome? Okay, because here what you get are kind of matrices. And so one important point here is that the way to relate so a matrix valued object to a number is to introduce a vector, but the number valued prediction, so the expectation value of a quantum theory only depends on the abstract operator and on the abstract vector. So the way you represent your operator or your vector shouldn't affect your result. Okay, so this is kind of important. And yeah, so only the outcome only depends on the abstract. So by abstract, I mean that you don't need here, for example, in the tutorial, you use this specific representation operator and your abstract vector, but not the explicit. And so that's why, and this I'm not going to go back into that. So if you're not really familiar with that, I encourage you to read the section 2.3 in the lecture note, which is about Hilbert space. Because again, what matters is really the abstract structure of a vector space and the abstract structure of operator acting as map on this abstract vector space. And for this, we need the notion of Hilbert space. So I went around yesterday during the tutorial where most of you define the Hilbert space. So many of the table thought about the distinction, what you have to think about when it's infinite dimensional compared to finite dimensional. So again, if you're not totally familiar, read the lecture notes here. It's only one page, so it's kind of quick. And it's going to remind you everything about this abstract vector space that we need to work with and the way maps act on abstract vector space. Okay, so any question here? So this was kind of to make the connection between. So what we did, we started from classical mechanics formulated in the Hamiltonian formulation. I kind of recall you quickly what are the properties that are going to be preserved or changed, kind of like this one is not valid, or for example, the commutativity here is going to be changed. How does this translate at the quantum level? Then, of course, when you are here, at the end of the day, we end up with usually objects that are linear maps. So we can solve, we have the feeling that indeed we are able to solve what we call a quantum mechanical problems, because we can find this kind of function if we know H and we know how to solve this equation. We can find X and P, the operator for at any time. Then the next question was, okay, usually these are linear maps, or if you want one example is R matrices. How do you get as an outcome a number? First, you need to introduce the easiest way is to introduce vector to get this kind of object. What is important here is that your outcome should only depend on the abstract operator and abstract vector. So that's why all this notion of Hilbert space operators is kind of important, okay? Now, what I want to do, if there is no question here, is to talk about the different time evolution picture. So here we started from the classical formalism and we quantize. So when we do that, the picture we get here is what we call the Heisenberg picture, okay? So what is the Heisenberg picture? Anyone can give me one sentence?
Observables evolve in state.
Sorry?
Observables evolve and evolve in time and stay fixed.
Yeah. So for example, when I wrote this object here, in fact here, indeed, this is of t. Okay, these are the kind of the expectation value. So this is a physical object, okay? And my state here are abstract states that I consider that do not evolve. So you see that we're going to come back on that equation because this is, this is a physical object. So we're going to see that we can indeed put the time dependence into the state. And what is the interest of doing that? Here you see that if you want to solve a quantum mechanical problem, what you have to solve is kind of matrix equation, okay? Or you have matrix value function. Whereas the idea is if we go to put the time dependence here, then this will be what we call the Schrödinger picture. Then we're going to get what you know as the Schrödinger equation, but the Schrödinger equation is for a vector, okay? So it seems that we kind of gain something to go from a matrix, if you want, to a vector equation. So this is kind of the idea why usually we use the Schrödinger representation. But again, when you do this canonical quantization starting from the Hamiltonian formalism of classical mechanics, what you get is a Heisenberg picture, okay? So now the question is, how do we go from one to the other? And what are the subtleties, depending if you have this some time independent Hamiltonian, or by time independent, I mean explicit time independence, okay? Or, so let's write this explicitly. Okay, so this is the next, so this was quickly to see the connection between classical quantum, starting from, again, the Hamiltonian formalism. So now the next section is going to be, I'm going to start again from this Heisenberg equation. And this is going to give me the opportunity to introduce the time evolution operator that I guess most of you are familiar with because it was part of the tutorial yesterday and I didn't have much questions. So, and it was also in the last question of the, and then I will mainly focus on the Heisenberg picture and Schrödinger picture. Then I will say just one word on the interaction picture because I think in the quiz someone told me that it was not very clear to what was this picture. Okay, so again, in the tutorial you've seen that you can have X and P as matrices. Now, if you look explicitly to an example, you are able to solve this equation for a particular example. But let's go back to this equation for an operator with no explicit time dependence. So in the tutorial, you've seen this with a explicit time dependence, and you add an additional term in this equation. So now I'm at the quantum level, so I'm not going to put any hat, okay? Just this time for this line, but then I'm going to forget about the hat, so don't forget that I'm just talking about operators. If there is any confusion, I will put back the hat. Yeah, so here it's for time. There is no explicit time dependence here. Otherwise, you remember, you need to add something like this. And this was part of the tutorial yesterday. What is the formal? So let's just focus on this formal. What is the formal solution here? The formal solution, so this is an equation. So do you know how to write it? So you will have, of course, the Hamiltonian. Zero so you can see that these two operators a at time zero and a at time t are kind of what we say unitary equivalent because they are related by what is a unitary operator here. And what is this unitary operator? This is what I'm going to call u of t, and u of t is my time evolution. So this was just about the time. So is this, so the time evolution operator, is it the more general expression for the time evolution operator? Or what is the assumption that I've made here to write it in this form? Yeah, very good. Okay, here, this is valid only for h, which is time independent. So by time independent, of course, I mean this explicit time depend. I'm missing some. So what is more generally the definition of the of this operator? So more generally, what you have is that this operator is a solution of this equation, differential equation. So u is the solution of where here h can have a explicit time dependence. And of course, we want to have a unique solution, an initial value problem. So to have a unique solution, we need to specify an initial condition. So it can be t equals zero or just a t zero here. So this is my definition. Okay, so this is the definition of this time evolution operator. This is a solution of this problem. Okay, what is the solution here of this, the general solution of this differential equation? Of course, you expect that when h is time independent, you recover that. So it's going to be kind of close to an exponent. It's going to be some exponential, I guess. So do you know what you need to add?
It's going to be a series solution. It's not going to be like precise exponential solution.
Yeah, so I'm going to give you directly the solution, but the way you solve that is by iteration, okay? So you can first put the first solution and then iterate, and it will give you the notion of time-ordered exponential. Where here, I'm going to use with this arrow to make explicit the time order, and I'm going to write explicitly what it is. So here it starts from T0 to T. And so what is that? This denotes, so the left to right. Logical ordering of the, so here, because T, now H depend on T, the sequence of H of T for different T is not going to commute anymore, okay? Sequence of operator. So are you familiar with this? So I'm going to write explicitly what it is, but are you familiar with that or not? Mm-hmm. And do you know how to find, are you able to prove that this is indeed at least the first step? That this is a solution starting from here or not?
Not really.
Not really, yeah, okay. So maybe I'm going to add for next tutorial a problem on that. So of course, people that are super familiar with that, you can skip it, and the other, you can do it step by step and at least think about it, because I think, so you're going to see this kind of definition often, so that's good if we, if at least you have the opportunity to think about it. So let me write it. What does it mean here? So what is that? Is, yeah, so let's maybe write in different steps. So it's again an exponential, so you have an infinite series, of course. Then you have this factor, 1 over I h bar. So this is an n, sorry. N. And then you have all this integration from dt1. Where here, you want now to consider the time order of this sequence of operator. Okay, and so here you can remove the time ordering by implementing it explicitly using the integral here. So here you see that it's always go from t0 to t, but I can, and it's going to cancel this factor. You can rewrite this as, and again, I'm going to add the problem in the next tutorial to make you do the first step, at least to make sure that you see it work. So from T0 to T for the last one, but the first one would be right here, with Tn, then maybe T0 to T3. dt2, t0 to t2, t1, and now it's ordered from left to right in the chronological ordering. So I don't need the t anymore, because you see that because t1 can go is smaller than t2. Okay, so here, let's write maybe the first few terms. Okay, so writing it like this, I have like ordered the value of t1, t2, tn. Okay, so here what I have is that t1 is less. Again, you can see that from the integration here. So t1 go from t0 to t2, then t2 will go from t0 to t3, so you have this. And then, so here I already ordered this sequence of H operator from HT1, HT2, HTN, okay? So from left to right. So of course now there are operators, and because there is a time, if there is a explicit time dependence, these operators are not going to commute, okay? So the order is important. Of course, if you don't have any explicit time dependence, then they commute, so you can get rid of this. You can go around with them. And of course, this is going to reduce to this simple equation that you're used to. Okay? And am I missing? No. Okay, the I is under and here is up with a minus, so it's the same thing. Okay. Okay, so this is the formal solution of, and yeah, normally I should send you a quiz today and I will maybe play a bit with, yeah, which kind of, depending if you change your order here, we're going to see that this has for effect that you could have also the other ordering, right to left, but I'm going to come back on that later. Okay. So here, as you can see, so we were, as I said, when we quantize classical mechanics using this canonical framework quantization scheme, what we get is that we get time dependent operator. And a priori, if I want to define this physical object, which is the expectation value of my operator, my state are not going to depend on time. So this is the Heisenberg picture, okay? So here, everything I did up to now is in the Heisenberg picture. Meaning the time dependence, so operator depend on time and state do not, okay? So this is the Heisenberg picture. And as I said, when you have a mechanical problem, then you have to solve this kind of equation that are matrix equations, okay? So the idea is, now can we go to another picture where the time dependence will be on the state, and can we directly work with the time evolution on state, so meaning on vectors? Is that possible? And that this is yes, is the Schrodinger picture. And so to write this explicitly, so to write this explicitly, of course, the starting point is the physical prediction that is going to be given by this expectation value. And as I said, this shouldn't depend on the choice of vector, or the choice of representation you use. Okay, so this should be, you should be able to work with any vector representation, the representation of the vector you want. So now, how do we go to the Schrodinger picture? So again, this is your starting point where this is so let me consistent without putting H here. So now I want to use, so let's first use the yeah, so here, more generally here, what you have is that A of t, yeah, maybe I should have wrote it here. So A of t is given by u dagger A0 u of t, okay? Where u is, so in the case of a time-independent Hamiltonian like here, it's exactly that, but then you can use also the formal definition here. So of course then, this is a kind of formal definition. You can ask all the questions you want about convergence here. So, and it's maybe one aspect why also the interaction picture can be interesting, because you can decompose your Hamiltonian in a part that you know how to solve and a part that can be seen as a perturbation, and the perturbation can be kind of small, so you can maybe work with a convergence issue. But here I'm not talking too much about that now. So let's just see. So here I want to introduce A of zero, okay? And So I'm just going to work first with the case H is time independent, and then we're going to see what A of zero, H T, H bar. And the point is that, so here I have the freedom to put my bracket where I want, okay? It's what was in the quiz yesterday. So you have can bracket like this, which you define A of T. But I could also say, oh, I want to define this object, okay? And this is what I'm going to call the Schrödinger state. In opposition to this state, that is the Heisenberg state, okay, where there is no time dependence. So this is and again, more generally, if for a time dependent Hamiltonian, you just define your Schrödinger state this way, okay? So now, but it's first easier to start like this to define, because now the question is, can we recover, well, so you already know, what is going to be, how the time evolution of this object is going to be given. It's going to be given by the Schrödinger equation, and indeed we can derive this just by differentiating here, okay? So here the only time dependence is in the t. You recover, if you differentiate this with respect to t, what you get is that indeed your state should satisfy this equation. We're here, yeah, well, I don't need to put the subscript here. And so one question you could have is that, what is H? As I said, H is coming from the, here I'm using the H that is coming from the canonical quantization procedure. So it's the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. So do we have a different Schrödinger, do we have a Schrödinger Hamiltonian? Is it important? So here in the time, we are again, H is time independent. So maybe this is why it's so simple. So let's go now to the case where H is time dependent, okay? See? Okay, so let's start. So any question first, maybe, before I, yeah.
I am not understanding very well the different features and how you relate them with the parentheses.
Okay, so, yeah. So this object is kind of a physical prediction, okay? It's, and this has, right now I was working, so we started with a classical system, okay? We kind of said, oh, we can quantize it kind of simply if this classical system indeed is in this Hamiltonian formulation. So now we have an operator, and we have seen that. So this operator has before, so you have x and p, your phase space variables that are function of time. Now x and p are operator of also time, and A is a general operator of time that usually can be expressed in terms of x and p, your operator x and p, okay? So these are now a valued object, a matrix valued object. So how do we get a number? Usually we use vectors, and you get this expectation value. But all the time dependence in this is in this operator. So when all the time dependence in this time operator, in the operators, it's what we call the Heisenberg picture. where here your state is time independent, okay? But now I know, because this operator is satisfying the Heisenberg equation, the formal solution to this equation is of this form, where of course here it could be, instead of zero, it could be a T0 and then a T minus T0, okay? Just where you choose your initial condition, okay? But this is a formal condition, where here, of course, it's zero, or it could be T0, but the point is that this is fixed, okay? It's my initial condition, it's fixed, it's not evolving like this. Time is my variable, my time evolution, depending on my time evolution. So I can write this, use this to rewrite this object, okay? And now what I'm saying is that, but this equation I could, so yeah, if I remove all this, this is still the same object, okay? And I'm just telling you that now what I want to do is consider that this as fixed, okay? And put the time dependence on the state. Okay, so now I'm still working with the same, my physical prediction is still the same, okay? I'm still going to talk about the same object. But now the interest is that all the time evolution is going to be on the state. And this is, I'm going to consider that my operator are time independent, okay? So this is what we call the Schrodinger picture. And again, why is it interesting? You see that here, if you want really to solve, find explicitly what is x of t and p of t, you have some matrix equation to solve, okay? You have this kind of equation, it's linear maps, so it's kind of huge objects. So the interest is that to go to this picture, then you going to deal with vectors. So it's a bit smaller. It's not a matrix, it's a vector now. So this Schrodinger equation that you're used to is a vector valued thing. So it can be simpler sometimes to solve explicitly in case you want to solve explicitly. And we're going to see that to go to the path integral formulation, we're going to start from the Schrodinger picture, but sometimes we need to go back to the Heisenberg picture. So it's kind of, yeah, you need to have a kind of clear idea of what are these two pictures. So it's really just having, so here I wrote the definition of the Heisenberg picture. You just, operators depend on time or evolve with time. State do not, and here the Schrodinger picture is the other way around, where you put the time dependence in your state. Okay, so is that?
Yeah.
Here? Okay, great. Okay, so let me now go to the more interesting case and maybe case where some confusion could come up. So let's try to make things not too messy here. So let's start again from, I want to start from this equation again, okay? We're here at this stage, we're still in the Heisenberg picture. And I want to apply this equation to a Heisenberg state, okay? So let's, because this is valid for any, can be, yeah, it's a general definition of U, so it's valid for also a time-dependent H. So this is my case, so now I'm just considering, so to make things clear for a moment, I'm going to add the subscript H to say that it's in the Heisenberg picture. And okay, so I just really rewrote this equation in the red box, just adding this, applying it to this state, Heisenberg state. But now I can use the fact that this is a unitary operator, meaning that U dagger U is equal to
identity.
Great. So I can add an identity here, for example. Okay. Why is that going to be useful? U dagger of T. Okay, so this is just identity. Why is it useful? What is this equation now? There is no time dependence, so it could mean that I can put it, write it like this, d over dt of u is equal to h bigger okay, so what is this object now that we have here? What is that? Yeah, so here I got the Schrodinger state. Okay, and the same here. Can you see with this? Is it too low or is it fine?
You can see it.
Okay, so this is the Schrodinger state. So what is that? This is what you, of course, you. What is the Schrodinger state satisfying is the Schrodinger equation. So meaning that here what you have is h t in the Schrodinger picture, okay? So this is your Hamiltonian in the Schrodinger picture. So what is, and in fact, of course, if this is time independent, then you can recover that, okay? Now, if it's not time independent, is it really fundamentally different from the Heisenberg Hamiltonian? So let's have a look to this object, okay? So what is my, what I'm telling you is that the Schrodinger Hamiltonian in Schrodinger is given by this relation H versus T is given by u of t. Then you have your h without substitute is h of h, it's the Heisenberg h, okay? The h that you would get from your quantization of your classical system. And here I'm considering where there is an explicit time dependence here, okay? And then it's u. And so what is this object? Okay, it's a phase space object where all the operators that are going to be into it are the x, are going to be polynomial of x or p, okay? Of course, then you can have some explicit time dependence. Okay, and but this explicit time dependence here is not, it's not an operator. So the only operators are going to be polynomial of x and p. So what, for example, let's consider that I have a term in p squared in my Hamiltonian. So example, p squared in my h. Okay, so now I want to look at this kind of thing, u of t, p squared, that is also a function of t, u dagger of t. And again, I'm going to use the same trick as here, meaning I can add some identity between operators, okay? Using the fact that this is, so p squared is just p times phi, okay? So here I can rewrite this as dagger of t, u of t, p of t, u dagger of t. Okay, and I can use two colors because, so again here, this is exactly the same thing because what I add here is only this term that is identity. But now I can regroup. Everything is associative here, so I can regroup that as this object and this object. Okay, and I can do that for any terms in my Hamiltonian. So what does it mean? This means that here, what I'm telling you is that H, the Hamiltonian, the Schrödinger Hamiltonian, is the same thing as the Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg picture, where now all your operators are of this form, u of t, x of t, u dagger of t, and okay, using the same trick that I use in this example here, you can imagine that you can do that term by term here. So, and of course you keep your time dependence. So finally what you obtain is that this is exactly x of t0. If t0 is your initial time, okay, then depending on your convention, but it's fixed, okay? Again, it's fixed, it's not going to evolve. So what does it mean here? What is the conclusion here? This means that your the Schrödinger Hamiltonian, okay, is the same polynomial or power theory in the position and momentum operator as the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. The only difference now is that the position and momentum operator in the Schrödinger picture are frozen to the initial time. Okay, so indeed you recover that you don't have this time dependence here. And you the only time dependence is when you have an explicit term. So maybe I can give you an example of Hamiltonian with an explicit time dependence if you're not really familiar with that. Yeah.
So you ask u to satisfy this equation here, right? IH bar is u dt equals u h.
Yeah.
Why did you choose this order instead of h u?
So and in fact, so now if you look at if you want to go to the, so this is a good point. Are you used to the other convention or?
Yeah, because look, for example, there in the derivation layer there for the time dependent h, the u dt would only be h times u, and then you'd already get the full Schrodinger equation, right? Without having to change the Hamiltonian. Because then you get h of t, u of t on psi h, which is already psi.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah. I'm just thinking. Because so let me I'm going to but so now you're right that this is my the order I chose here, but now if you look at what is the equation satisfied by u if instead of h you want to work with h of s hs meaning the Schrödinger one, so if you use the definition of what is hs here, okay, or if you replace h by hs going around with that, what you're going to get is that I h bar du over dt is going to be hs times u, okay? Meaning that if you want to write the u, the explicit solution of u in terms of the Schrödinger Hamiltonian here is going to be so what is, where is my definition? Yes,
it's maybe.
is going to be with this definition, but if you put a subscript HS inside your time ordering here, then the time ordering you're considering is not going to be the left to right, but the right to left, okay? Because your equation is going to be the same. But again, everything here is consistent, and in practice, you will see that it's the same Hamiltonian, except that you consider that it's at the frozen time, and the only, and again, most of the time you're going to work with time independent, of course, I mean this explicit time dependence, okay? Hamiltonian, so then things are exactly the same. So then, yeah, your point saying that things would be simpler if I had used the other convention.
I think you would have had the same problem, but then when you try to define the Hamiltonian on the other side.
Anyway, like you have to. Once you choose kind of a way, then everything is kind of related. You have your convention that follow from one another. So maybe, I don't think I have, what I want to do now, because I don't want to maybe start something too new. First take question and then say a few words about this interaction picture that is also called the Dirac picture.
I'm a little confused on how you got x of t zero out of evolving x of t through the u of t.
Okay, so what is okay, so here what you have is that for any, so let's use that for x of t. So what is the x of t in terms of, let's choose now t zero.
Just you're using that, okay.
Yeah, so this is u dagger t x zero, but again,
I see.
Okay. So I have like, if you're careful with that, what I have is u. So I multiplied by u on the left and by u on the right. Okay. So I get exactly this. That is here. Okay. Any more questions on that? Okay, so these are the main two pictures we're going to work with in to go to the path integral formalism. But another picture that also exists and is often very often used, in particular if you're going to work with kind of complicated system, is going to be what we call the interaction picture or Dirac picture. Okay, and you've seen that in tutorial one, so I'm not going to spend too much time, but the idea of this interaction picture is that it's kind of an intermediate representation between the Schrödinger and Heisenberg picture, because both the state and the operator are going to carry some time dependence. But we're going to see that usually, what we're going to try to do is to split. The idea is that in case where it's useful to split your Hamiltonian in what we're going to call what can be seen as an easy Hamiltonian, meaning it's the Hamiltonian of a system that you can solve, and the difficult Hamiltonian, whereas it's going to be something that maybe you cannot solve, but it can be seen as perturbation compared to the main Hamiltonian. And then the interaction picture is going to be useful if you really want to study this this kind of perturbation, okay? Because we're going to see that the state are going to evolve with respect to the difficult Hamiltonian, meaning that you're just going to capture what is the perturbation for the state evolution, but the operator are going to evolve according to the easy Hamiltonian, so the operator. So let's maybe rewrite it explicitly for people who is not familiar with this interaction picture. Okay, a few of you. So it's still useful that I don't have too much time, so I'm not going to start something new. So let me take the time to talk a bit about it. Okay, so which board? Maybe it's the first. And if you didn't have time, if you're not familiar with this picture, time evolution picture. If you didn't have time to look at the bonus question, no, the, it was not the bonus question, but the, I think it's problem 2.2 maybe from the tutorial yesterday, I really encourage you to go through it just to see kind of the, what I did in, what you do in this tutorial is kind of what I did from here. You start from the Heisenberg picture or Schrodinger picture more precisely, and using kind of from the expectation value and working around with brackets and this kind of thing, you can work out the definition of the different objects. Okay, so where are we? So H, no, it's the interaction picture. Or also called Dirac. So let me give you maybe just an Hamiltonian. That quite obviously, if you were giving this Hamiltonian, maybe you would. So it's in the S means that here I give you in the Schrodinger picture, okay? So of course, any time dependence is frozen for the P and X operator is going to be frozen here. So I have this usual kinematical term. Then I have this other term that you should all recognize. And I'm going to add kind of a maybe perturbation or let's put something that seems not so simple. Okay, so you see that S here means Schrodinger. It's a time-dependent operator, and indeed it's written as, so the T, for the X and P operator, the T is frozen to the initial time, but I can still have my time dependence that here is given here. Okay, so here, would you, how would you split this? I guess it's quite obvious. This Hamiltonian. So you have the free part, if you want, here. But even this part, you should be familiar with that, no? What is that? Yeah, so you see this harmonic oscillator, and then there is no explicit time dependence here, so it's what you have been kind of working on the tutorial yesterday, you know how to deal with this Hamiltonian. So this is what I'm going to call H0S. And it's what we can see as the easy part of the Hamiltonian, okay? Then you have the difficult part here, which is this H1S. So you see, we split the idea here is that in this situation, it's super useful to split the Hamiltonian into this easy and difficult part. Because we know how to solve this problem here. So first, maybe one, why is it also called interaction picture? It's also often because, so maybe not in this case, but mean it's often used when you have some particle interacting. So usually the way you can do is to consider that your easy Hamiltonian is going to be your free Hamiltonian, describing the free particles. And then the interaction terms between the particles is going to be the difficult part, okay? And usually you can study that as perturbation, okay? And even when we're going to go to the path integral formalism, we're going at some point maybe introduce Feynman diagrams where it's all about interaction between particles. And indeed, this is the way it is done with Feynman diagram is it's in a perturbative treatment, okay? It's term by term. And here, this would be the idea is that the interacting term is going to be treated perturbatively, meaning that it's not exactly, but you do kind of term by term, okay? Okay, so here we can split this Hamiltonian. And so what is nice in this picture is then that So I'm not going to recall all the definition of the what is the state in the interacting picture, what is a, I mean, operator in the interacting picture. It was in the tutorial yesterday, but I just want to give you the main result is that now in the interaction picture, with the I assuming interaction picture, your state, your operators are going to evolve according to the easy Hamiltonian. Easy, I'm not sure it's a very physical term, but I guess you have an idea of what I mean here. And indeed, you will have a very similar evolution that you have in the Heisenberg picture for your state. But now the U that you consider, the time evolution operator that you consider, is built only with this part of the Hamiltonian, so the easy part, okay? Then it's the same thing as you know. And this is in the Schrodinger, so meaning that it's at fixed time if you want. Okay, so this is for the operators and then the state. In this interaction picture, evolve with respect to the difficult Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian, and you have a kind of Schrödinger equation for them. But now the Hamiltonian you consider is the interaction Hamiltonian. Where H1i, of course, the explicit definition of this do I have the explicit definition here? Yeah, so here, this is related to H1S, but you also need to evolve it with U of, yeah. So here, the explicit definition, check tutorial one. I don't have it on the top. Okay, but so this is the idea of this interaction picture, is that it's kind of an intermediate step between the Schrödinger and Heisenberg. And then you have this kind of nice fitting, okay? Okay, thanks, I'm going to conclude here. So I will send you an email for the quiz because I was maybe thinking to go further. So I'm not sure I have enough for the quiz for today. If not, you will have a longer one tomorrow. But don't hesitate to send me, to let me know if you have questions, if something is not clear, because one also very interesting aspect of the quiz is that for us, we receive kind of feedback from you, and then we can, the point with this PSI lecture, as you kind of start to understand, I guess, is that the pace is kind of quick. You don't really have time to sit down and think about what you learn because it's the next day is already the next lecture. And so if something is not clear today, let me know.